Another triple feature. Welcome to another triple feature. I'm Gordon McAlvin. I do multiplex, as the thing below says. With me, as always, are Joe Dunn of Joe Loves Crabby Movies and a billion other webcomics.
Hello.
And Tom Razzleton, who is a
Hi.
webcomic.
I did one once. It was well received.
You misspelled all right that third
No,
time.
wait, what? The third time? All right, all right. I was in a rush. I was trying to get that one in there.
Right. So tonight on the triple feature, we are going to be talking about three things. That seems to be the pattern. We may not do that every single time, but we are going to talk about three things. First up will be Fatale by Ed Brubaker and Sean Phillips. Excuse me, one second. Excuse me. Books one and two. In other words, issues 1 through 10. And then we'll be talking about. Oh, I'm sorry. Ed Brubaker. Sorry,
Ooh.
Matthew
I can't wait to talk
McConaughey.
about that poster for about 20 minutes.
Ed TV with Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson, clearly the most important of the Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson team-ups. And then finally, we'll be talking about True Detective by Nick Pizzolatto and Cary Fukunaga, starring Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson.
So if you got a thing for Southern drawls, you're in the right place.
Yeah.
Aye. No, that was terrible. There's people in the actual South that are gonna stab me now. Sorry.
Well, fortunately, we only have like 10 people that actually watch this.
Hallelujah.
But yeah, so that was me trying some new technological fanciness, sharing pictures with you. But yeah, let's start with Fatale. For those of you who are not familiar with it, Fatale, of course, again, is by Ed Brubaker and Sean Phillips. It's kind of a noir sort of story, but it has some supernatural elements. The first volume takes place largely in the 1950s. The whole series really centers around a woman who has mysterious powers over men. Basically, she can get them to do anything she wants them to. And so the first arc takes place in the 50s. The second arc, The Devil's Business, Book Two, takes place mostly in the 1970s. A later arc ends up taking place mostly in the 90s. I don't know why he sticks with the odd decades for the most part, but it jumps around a lot in a few other storylines. We're going to be talking about books one and two just as a jumping on point. I know Joe and Tom weren't both as familiar with the series as I was. I've been reading it since the beginning. I've been a longtime fan of Brubaker and Phillips from their Criminal days, from Sleeper, actually. And so I will literally buy anything that they do, no matter what. What about you two? Have you guys read a lot of Brubaker and Phillips's work, or just Brubaker's like superhero stuff, or what?
Yeah, I was only familiar with Brubaker from his run on Captain America, and I was aware of Criminal, but had never read it. I think I might have maybe been on the side, in the margins, aware of Fatale, but I had no idea what it was even about, so this was a completely new read for me.
I knew them, but not together. I really love Phillips' work and Brubaker. I'd read the superhero stuff, but never read any of their stuff together. So this was definitely a first, and I had never heard of it before. So.
Cool. We talked about doing Criminal for a little bit, just because it seemed like a good natural pairing with True Detective, but I ended up steering things towards Fatale mostly just because Fatale is going right now. The fourth trade I think just came out, so they're on like issue 20 or 21, and it's a really solid series. It's similar to Criminal. But obviously, because it has these supernatural elements, it's different enough that it doesn't feel like just an extension of Criminal. I really think, like, I think of these two together. I read Captain America for a while. I think I fell off at some point when Bucky was still Captain America. Spoilers, I guess, for anybody.
Spoilers on that 5-year-old storyline, people.
Well, you know, I mean, also for the upcoming movie that's a handful of people might not be completely aware of. I know my girlfriend, for instance, isn't aware of who the Winter Soldier is.
Don't even say it. It's a month away. Let it rest.
I'm letting her be as in the dark as I can on that one, because you know, if it's a surprise to her, then great. So Fatale, let's hear what you guys think about the series. I don't know, we could talk about just both the arcs together, I suppose. It really does just kind of flow naturally, I think, more than even though each 5-issue sequence has a solid beginning, middle, and end, it does kind of flow, I think.
I don't know what to make of it, I guess. I read the first trade, and it really sufficiently creeped me out, and I can't remember the last time I read a comic where that happened. I read a lot of superhero stuff, so that's probably my fault. But I used to read a lot of Dark Horse stuff and some of the Grendel books back in the 90s, and those used to kind of weird me out. But this was, I don't know, it was very, it felt very tangible, and I don't know what it is. It's maybe more the art style felt rooted in something I could, that looked and felt real. I guess overall I just walked away with just that general kind of creepy vibe.
I think it's good that you recommended that we read both, because the first one I really disliked. I thought it was a lot of gibberish. It's a lot of it's all tone, but it's like it's a lot of characters saying nothing. And you're supposed to read into it, but how much can you really read into it when they're not really giving you anything? I think there's a point in the story where the character says, "I'm sorry, I was confused," and then another character says, "I was confused too." But it's like, yeah, guess what? I'm confused as well. Like, they're just not saying anything, and I really wanted to be able to sink into the story because I wasn't sinking into the characters. Especially, I mean, if you break it into each book is 5 chapters, and the first 2 chapters, I would say, I wasn't even sure who was who. Like, there are characters that look similar, and names are said, but things jump. Like, it'll be 2 pages of one character, then 2 pages of another character, and you're not sure who they are and how they relate to each other. It moves quick, and it's not interesting enough where I'm like, okay, let me go back and make sure I know what's what. At one point, I was just trying to, like, let me get through this and then see if it makes sense. So I was very frustrated by that. And by the time I finished the first book, I was like, ugh, yuck. The second book, though, I feel like is really more straightforward. It's weird. You won't get this book unless you read the first book. Like, you won't understand a lot of important stuff. But it's more linear. Like, it's start to finish, and you follow characters more fluidly than you do in the first book. And I think that it reads a lot better for that. If we'd read just one book, I wouldn't have stuck with it. I would have been like, this is garbage. I'm not going on.
You know, I was gonna say I didn't feel that. I mean, both books jump around in time a lot. But I thought the second one did a better job of saying, all right, you're in this period, now you're in this period, and also showing how the two periods relate to each other.
I had zero problems jumping through time. The times are fine. Like, everything makes sense. There's the protagonist in the future with he has the white stripe in his hair and one leg. Yeah. So he's pretty easy to pick out. But so time jumping is no problem. It's really the first book where it's like, there's 2 reporters and there's 2 detectives, and 2 of them kind of look the same. And then, like, they all have relationships with this woman, but who is this woman? And who does she have a long-term relationship with? And who is she just newly hooked up with? And there's a lot going on. But I've said my say.
I can definitely agree with you. It's a little hard to follow this, particularly that first arc. I do think that when I was rereading it for this show, I had a little easier time following it than I did the first time around. And as much as I love Sean Phillips's art, I have to agree that sometimes his character designs make the characters hard to tell apart. particularly in the 1950s arc, where, you know,
everyone dresses the same, and like
everybody dresses the same. Everybody's got short hair. You know, the easiest way to tell somebody apart is if they have dark hair or blonde hair. And when you have two people with light hair, which I think are the two
characters. Guess what? One of the cops has blonde hair. One of the cops has dark hair. One of the reporters has blonde hair. One of the reporters has dark hair.
Right.
You worked it out great.
it got a little confusing. I don't remember exactly when I was completely on board with the series. I think it might have been during the second arc, too. I just kept buying it just because I love and want to support their work. Particularly now, I've grown to love the series more and more as it's continued. It probably helps that I think book three or four. No, three. Sorry. Three was largely self-contained stories. And it did jump around a lot, but it's kind of filling in a lot of these gaps. Whereas the first book, you know, it starts in present day, and you're like, okay, who are these people? And it jumps back to the 50s, and you're like, okay, now, really, who are these people? I'm not sure if he was entirely successful in making the whole mystery as interesting as it needed to be, but I think it becomes interesting more later.
There's so much establishing, and I think that the second storyline benefits from that establishing. Like the character of Mitch, the movie star. When you see his journey from start to finish, you say, oh, I get it. I see how this femme fatale can really tell 1,000 stories with this character and with her enemy, who's established in the first book and clearly carried through in the second in a really interesting way. And you look at it, and I look at Mitch's storyline, and I say, oh, I see this. This can be like 100 bullets. You have your basic setup, and you can apply it to anybody. You can do anything with it, and that's great. That's exciting. That's the excitement I was missing from the first storyline.
Yeah, that makes sense, because you kind of thought like you were stuck with these characters in that time period, and then the second arc really just kind of turns it around a little bit. I did find the second arc a lot easier to digest, I think. I'm wondering, though, if the first arc is going to, like, this has to be a finite story. So at some point, I feel like it's got to come full circle.
I think I've read that they think of this as an ongoing.
Really?
Don't quote me on that. And maybe by ongoing, they just mean it's going to be, like, you know, 60, 70 issues or something like that. Certainly at issue 20 or 21 or whatever they're on right now, I forget exactly. There is no end in sight. And I think, you know, I want there to be an ending just because I prefer stories with endings. I'm pretty happy sticking around with whatever they have going, for the foreseeable future anyway. I know it's not, they're not like self-contained arcs in the sense that the Criminal was. Criminal was fully an anthology series, for instance. They did have characters that popped up here and there, but it was each story was finished. Whereas Fatale, it really does feel like it's building up a mythos, mythology, whatever, around this idea of the central woman. There are definitely some mysteries left about her.
For sure, like absolutely. There's all kinds of stuff going on. Like, it would have been easier to access this book and really jump on board if it was just a mysterious woman that has a control over men that cannot be explained. It becomes a lot less easy to like fall in love with or even recommend when an octopus Cthulhu comes out of nowhere. Like, that's weird, and they don't really talk about it. They don't get into it, and there's pros and cons to that, but I don't know. I don't want to... You can guess all day about it, and that's great, but I don't know. I almost want it to be simpler so I can enjoy it more.
Well, yeah, that's something I wanted to talk about, the supernatural elements of it, too, because, when Gordon originally recommended it in line with us reviewing EdTV and True Detective... I was like, oh, there's kind of like a mini theme here, maybe less so with that TV. But the supernatural part of it is actually pretty overt in Fatale, And it's frustrating because you're like, I feel like there's so many smoke and mirrors wrapped around it, except for Octopus Guy. Like, that's a serious thing. Like, do I need to read the third and fourth arcs to learn more, evidently?
I mean, I get you.
Or they keep kind of, you know, stringing you along.
It's so strange. It sort of comes out of nowhere. At the same time, there's part of the storyline where one of the characters flashes back to himself as a child, and he talks about seeing things out of the corner of his eye, you see little octopus men in a car, and you're like, yes. And you get excited. You're like, tell me more. And then he's like, oh, I was a dumb kid. I don't really remember that well.
Yeah.
Yeah, there is definitely a lot going on, and you get a better idea of the bigger picture over the next, you know, 10 issues, as you would expect. But by no means do you feel like you have the whole story at this point. I, you know, like I said, I've been on board. I'm enjoying it. It's one of my first reads every time it comes out on Comixology. It did take a little bit for it to get to that point. You know. Hopefully he enjoyed it well enough.
You know, it great tone, really violent and sexy. I really love that. The art's great. It is, you know, if it had been one story arc we read, I would have said, forget it, don't even touch it. But I'm kind of curious what happens. So after reading the second storyline.
If nothing else, the back issues, older than, you know, 2 or 3 months on Comixology, they're $2. So give it another couple of issues and see if you're hooked at that point. Certainly for $10, I guess the trades probably cost about $10 from Amazon. But, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, we can, I think, move on to the most important element of the week, EdTV.
Yes!
you guys love it.
I don't know about you guys. I had not seen EdTV before. I was a huge fan of the Truman Show when it came out, and they were it was kind of like the battle of the TV show about a guy.
Yeah, although, you have to choose one or the other. Yeah.
It was like you could only see Mission to Mars or Red Planet, or
right,
but not
or,
both.
Dante's Peak or Volcano.
Yes, exactly. And I was Team Truman, and you know, I'm just a massive Peter Weir fan, and the other thing is I'm not a huge Ron Howard fan. I absolutely love Apollo 13, but you know that's kind of. That really sums up my opinion of Ron Howard. It's entirely the stories that make his movies good or bad. Ron Howard himself doesn't bring anything to the table. He doesn't get in the way of the, you know, the movies that he makes, but I don't think he adds anything to them. You guys might completely disagree on that, but
well, I think if you're holding him up against Weir, then yeah, absolutely. I mean, Opie's fairly innocuous as a director. He's competent. That's, I feel like that's the nicest thing you can say about Ron Howard. The Da Vinci Code was very stylish. I don't know. I mean, yeah, I guess, you know, if you're ever gonna put these two movies up against each other, TV is gonna lose every time because Truman Show was first. It's become very almost prophetic in how reality television has, you know, just kind of permutated throughout our lives. And EdTV is just more kind of a goof, I feel like. The other thing I was going to say about it is that, like, with most Ron Howard movies, it's like, how many famous people can we cram into it because they want to work with Ron Howard for some reason?
Clint Howard's got to be in there somewhere, too.
Right, Clint Howard and his hair plugs. So, yeah, I don't know. Joe, what were you thinking?
Look, The Truman Show is a film, and EdTV is a movie. Okay, the church is punk rock, and EdTV is pop music. Like, they're different audiences. The Truman Show is a masterpiece, and it will win every time when they go up against each other because it's saying something, it's doing something. Whereas EdTV is just about having fun, and it's about you know, sort of the fun of reality TV and that sort of phenomenon. Whereas The Truman Show is a study of character and a study of storytelling, and you know, it's completely different. It is apples and Washington State apples.
The thing is, I don't think that a movie just being an entertainment, just being a light comedy is enough of an excuse, because the EdTV has some really good parts. It has some really funny parts. It has some oddly prescient parts.
I just want to say on the record, I had seen EdTV. I own EdTV. I've seen EdTV more than The Truman Show. I really enjoy EdTV. So please, I don't want that. Like, I'll be the defender if I have to be.
I'm not, you don't need to completely defend it. It's not bad. It's not a bad movie. It was fun. It was light. It was fluffy. But, I enjoyed it. I have this sort of, I was a little confused when Elizabeth Hurley was in it for like 5 seconds and she's like all over the poster. I suppose that's just because she's Elizabeth Hurley.
This was at the height of Hurley. This was right after, it was at the height of her popularity, you know?
Yeah, post Austin Powers, pre Bedazzle.
Yeah.
But, partly, in part because of that and a few other things, I was expecting a slightly different movie. EdTV is a straight-up rom-com. And I love romantic comedies, but I thought they were going to get a little bit more into the reality TV stuff than they did. And when they did that, I thought it was pretty interesting. But it's like, you know, Jenna Elfman, whatever her name was, Jenna Elfman can't hack being on a TV show for like 3 days.
Without crying about it?
Really? Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
It just, the time frame seemed kind of ridiculously condensed. It just, there were some parts that just sort of strained logic, I think. And not that it needs to be some like masterpiece of sense to win me over, but it wasn't funny enough to make me not think about that kind of stuff. It was good.
Well, there's three things, well, maybe three, at least two things that I think EdTV does well. It represents what a windfall something like this would be to the average person. Like, they talk about, oh, it's going to make us rich and this is going to change our lives, and the excitement and the anticipation of being involved in something like that, it becomes very much of a be careful what you wish for situation. Yeah. Versus Truman Show, where this is a life that's thrust on someone who's unwilling. EdTV, Ed's all volunteering for it. The second thing that it does, I mean, it's kind of like the Funhouse Mirror version of Truman Show, and I hate to keep using that comparison, but it's there. EdTV is really less about what happens to Ed and more about what happens to the people who orbit Ed. Woody Harrelson, his brother, is trying to leverage the show to advertise his business. It affects Ed's relationships. It affects his parents. It uncovers all this stuff about his family that he never knew about. All the people that orbit Truman are very much wanting to be closer to Truman because of his fame. Everyone on EdTV wants to get away from Ed because of his fame. So that's kind of interesting.
But not at first. They show the attraction and then the backlash.
It's a monkey's paw, really, the whole thing.
They explore it thoroughly.
Yeah, it just resolves itself clumsily. The out that he finds.
If they explored it as thoroughly as I would have liked. I think they touched on a lot of things more in Grace Notes that I would have liked to have seen more of and a little bit less Jenna Elfman. I don't find her, you know, endearingly charming.
This was at the height of Elfman. You have to appreciate her.
This was post Dharma and Greg. This was pre grown up Fisher.
I was never really on board with her. She's fine. She's a very attractive actress.
Elfman. She's one of those actresses, and I don't want to, this sounds cruel, but she should be typecast, I feel, because whenever she steps outside of it, I go, this isn't what I like about you, you know, like on Dharma and Greg, where she's bubbly and effervescent, and, you know, hippie-ish. I get all that. But when she tries to be, like, serious drama and ugly crying, I was just like, gosh, it's not you, Jenna. It's not a good look. Speaking of which, the other thing that I wanted, you were talking about, like, this being a romantic comedy and maybe giving us a bridge into True Detective here, but McConaughey in this movie is full on McConaughey. Yes. Like, this is his how, why not? But this is like his, how to lose a guy in 10 gay, 10 gays, 10 days. How to lose 10 gays. How to lose a guy in 10 days, failure to launch, his like that deep rut of romantic comedies that he was in for so long, this lands smack in the middle of him. And watching him, while at the same time watching True Detective for this show, trying to get kind of caught up on that, I'm like, this man as a performer is miles away from where he used to be. It's astonishing.
But it's not bad. Like, this Ed TV McConaughey is probably as close to McConaughey as you're actually going to get, the real person. Like, and it's charming, and it's fun. Sure. It's the kind of guy you want to hang out with. And that, with Woody Harrelson in this movie, who is basically a grown-up Woody from Cheers, is great. Yeah. Like, then those two together, like, you want it's like you want to be part of that. You know, you want to be friends with them. You want to be the other guy at the pool table. And
there's only one aspect of the real McConaughey that I think was missing from Ed TV.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you couldn't do that on screen, right? But
you know, not in a PG.
I think it's great. Like, this is definitely in the height of the first McConaissance. Everyone remembers that, right? But it's right there, and it's for real, like right in the middle of the whole romantic comedy thing. And this, I think, is of all his romantic comedies, is the most accessible to everybody. Like, I think the other ones are straight up girly films, whereas this is fun. This is even family fun, I would say.
Yeah. You know, I have to point this out too. You mentioned, like, you want to be a third guy at the pool table. Adam Goldberg.
Yeah.
Right? He was Matthew McConaughey's best friend in Ed TV and How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. So, what's worse, being the guy who makes the romantic comedies over and over and over, or being the guy who plays the friend of the guy who makes the romantic comedies over and over again?
We have to realize this was at the height of Goldberg.
This was
close days for the friends.
Yeah, my wife was like, wasn't he in How to Lose a Guy? I was like, oh my God, you're right, he was.
The Dissolve, based out of Chicago, does this movie of the week thing, and Dazed and Confused, I think, was last week's. This week is American Graffiti. I don't know if they're doing the From Dusk Till Dawn teen coming of age movies, but you know, McConaughey and Goldberg were both in. I think that was Goldberg in Dazed and Confused, right?
Yeah, he was in it.
And so that's been, like, I can't remember Goldberg from anything else now. I know he was in a few other things. I know he had a little bit more of a career than the long hair hippie guy from Dazed and Confused. but he kind of fell off the face of the planet. So when he came up in Ed TV, I was like, hey, it's that guy. I like that guy.
Yeah, you're like, oh, it's good to see him in a movie that's 15 years old or whatever.
Yeah. And anyway, so Ed TV, it was fun. I think Joe was
I recommended it only because it starred Woody and Matthew, and I thought that was too priceless when we built this show around True Detective. It was too priceless.
So we might as well move to the main attraction of today's whatever episode, True Detective by Nick Pizzolatto, and I think that's how you pronounce his name, I don't really know, and Cary Fukunaga. HBO's True Detective started about 2 months ago, or a little over that, actually, because there was a skip week in there, but it ran for 8 parts, and when this show started, I immediately started watching it because I was familiar with Cary Fukunaga from Sin Nombre, which is a movie that he wrote and directed and wrote as well, about a young, I forget, Central American, I think, girl who has to sneak across the border to get into the United States and get away from some thugs. And it is a harrowing, amazing film. And I've been highly, like, just enthusiastically recommending this movie to anybody that's enjoyed True Detective. Because the direction in True Detective is amazing, and that it's his first film. He's only done one other feature since, which was the Michael Fassbender, Mia Wasikowska, Jane Eyre, which was beautifully done, but the story is Jane Eyre, and I'm not a big fan of that story. It just seems like a bunch of bad shit happening to a good woman, and it's just not a lot for me to latch onto. But people who do love the novel will probably enjoy it on its own merits. I don't know about you guys, if you're big Jane Eyre fans.
Well, so you prefer True Detective, a story about a lot of bad shit happening to a lot of women.
Well, yeah, well, it's just that there's a little bit more going on in True Detective, I think.
Sure.
And at the risk of reviewing Jane Eyre, there's no agency in it. Like, bad shit happens to her, and then something good happens to her, and she is not responsible for any of it. Whereas in True Detective, there's a lot of bad shit happening to women and some, you know, boys too. Let's not forget them. Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson as Rust and Marty are, you know, they take it upon themselves as cops at first. Sorry for a really mild spoiler for those of you who haven't watched it. And then later as detectives, private detectives, to right this wrong as much as they can. And I think that's all I need to say at this point. Had you guys heard about True Detective before it launched? Was it kind of on your radar? What I was going to say earlier, actually, is that I was in from week one, and like for the first couple of weeks, I was like, why isn't anybody else talking about this show? It's awesome. And then like when I think episode five or
four.
Four.
It's four.
Four comes out with the 6-minute tracking shot at the end, then everybody starts talking about it. And I'm like, thank you. Somebody else I could talk about this show with. Because I was like, after the first episode for me, like glued to HBO Go every Sunday. And like this, the number of people who are into it just grew and grew and grew every single week. And until apparently on the finale, HBO Go actually crashed because it was so popular.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, it I guess it was a grower.
yeah. I remember hearing about True Detective before it aired, and we don't have HBO in the house, but we're using HBO Go, which they said it is totally cool. You can do that if you have somebody else who has HBO in your family. And I remember hearing about True Detective, and I was like, I couldn't quite reconcile. I was like, Woody Harrelson and Matthew McConaughey are doing a detective series on HBO, of all places? I'm like, weren't they in EdTV?
Yeah. Why are they stars of EdTV?
Why are they doing this? Like, it didn't seem to line up to me, because, I mean, it's less true than it used to be, but television still has that stigma a little bit, where it's like, well, you know, you're a movie star or you're a television star, and I'm thinking, like, these two guys are movie guys. I was trying to even think of the last time I saw them on television. Cheers? When? Like, you know?
The landscape has changed completely. Like, TV is the place where real storytelling is happening, and, you know, real talent is coming back to tell long-form story. And I think that's great. I mean, if Kevin Spacey can go to Netflix, Woody Harrelson and Matthew McConaughey can spend 8 weeks on the biggest network on TV.
Yeah.
If David Fincher can slum it in TV and do the first couple of episodes of House of Cards, it's legit. I was always a film guy. I never really got into TV that much. I mean, sitcoms and stuff, notwithstanding, of course. But in the last like 10 years, the TV has really taken over as the medium for these like smaller stories. Like, can you imagine True Detective as a movie? Even something like, even when they do something approaching this sort of, you know, subject matter, things like Seven, it's always, they up the ante. Like, Seven was over the top gross, in my opinion. I wasn't a huge fan of it, as much as I do love David Fincher. You know, it had, like, movie needs to be bigger and more sensationalistic, and TV, it seems, can get away with doing these smaller, grittier, more real stories. You know, some exceptions here and there. You know, obviously indie films can get away with smaller stories, but like, all it seems like the major labels, the major studios are making is blockbuster films these days, and you know, big budget comedies, and occasionally the big crowd, broad crowd pleaser dramas, and sometimes Oscar bait. But the Oscar bait is like King's Speech, you know. It's not, I don't know. I mean, it's, Hollywood just seems to be broadening, or not Hollywood, because, but movies in general just seems to be broadening, kind of going for the lower, you know, the bigger buck, the lower, lowest common denominator, or a lower common denominator, if not the lowest one.
Well, I mean, we should point out that the storytelling, or the way that these stories are being told, you know, another way to say storytelling, is broadening as well, because, I mean, it's worth pointing out that True Detective is going the American Horror Story route, where they're changing up the cast. So it's, if you have these A-list, A-tier, you know, top-tier stars agreeing to do a show, it's not so crazy when you hear that it's only a, you know, an 8-week or, to them, maybe 3 or 4 month commitment. And they do it, and then they win an Emmy, and then they're back on the big screen before you know it.
Yeah, I mean, when you put it into perspective with Lord of the Rings, you know, taking a year of their life for, you know, admittedly a 12-hour movie, sort of, it seems almost easy, but you know, it's, yeah, you're absolutely right that the long form stuff is really kind of starting to sing in TV. And I think it helps a lot that they're going towards shorter seasons in American television. Obviously, the BBC has been doing that for a long time. But, you know, Hannibal's 13-episode season. Game of Thrones is a 13-episode season. Not that anybody on Game of Thrones is a huge movie star anymore. Peter Dinklage gets some business outside of it. Lena Headey gets a little. Sean Bean was the biggest star that show's ever had, though. And
will be forever, because Bean rules all.
True. It's true. But when, you know, as we all know, he dies, they just kind of let all the characters take over in that one. Hannibal, I think. Did I already say that?
But the shorter seasons are great. It's no filler. It's all, like, plot points, and still strong character, but, like, you're not waiting around for the Red Wedding. It happens, and then it's amazing, and it takes over the internet. Like Twitter blows up like a madhouse, and that's why it's exciting. That's why TV is exciting right now.
That's really it. It's the filler that killed me on so many TV series. Like shows like Alias, where they had this big central mystery, and then they would dick around for like hours and hours of television before they reveal anything. Partly, you know, they just didn't have a plan.
For me, it's Lost. Like, I lived and died on that show for, you know, 6 years, whatever it was, and I wouldn't trade any of it. Like, I love it, but, like, if it was tightened up, it could have been the greatest show in the world for everybody instead of just me.
I think Battlestar Galactica could have been a lot tighter, And I think if they were to start it now, it would be. They would do shorter seasons with the same budget and be able to get away with much more of the action stuff that they obviously stopped being able to afford after the second season. long form shows are really transforming television. And I know we're getting away from True Detective by waxing on about that maybe a little too long. But it's, I think it's been really exciting. The avowed movie guy that literally didn't watch a single TV drama for years and years. Now I watch 6 or 7 every year. Mad Men, Game of Thrones. I'm on board with True Detective forever. I suppose Nick Pizzolatto could drop the ball next season. Who knows? But
is Pizzolatto? Did he work on The Killing?
He wrote, I think, a couple of episodes of it.
Okay.
But yeah, that was kind of him cutting his teeth on TV. I don't think he was largely involved with the plot of it.
Okay.
But he has his roots in writing, some horror short stories, I believe, and he has one novel that apparently is apparently makes True Detective look like It's a Wonderful Life.
Well, I mean, that says a lot towards the ending of True Detective. But do we want to go into spoilers?
I'm nervous.
Anyway, but let's get to the show.
Yeah, let's talk about the show. We can get into spoilers towards the end after a little bit of a warning. Tom.
Yes.
Sorry.
Huh?
Let's hear your.
I just want to let you guys go. I didn't want to interrupt on that one. It's good. It's good.
With the show.
What happened? I started watching the show, I think, when the fourth episode happened and everybody went nuts about that tracking shot. That got back to me. I said, I better start watching this show. And I put the first episode under my belt. And after that, kind of gave up on it until we talked about watching it for the triple feature. I was like, oh, back to work. And I hadn't given up on it because I didn't like it. It's just a very heavy... it's a heavy scene, man. And especially the first four... In hindsight, the first four episodes are very dense. They're very heavy. They're kind of satisfying. After that fourth episode, then, it's off to the races. And I felt like the second half of it was a lot more... I was much more invested in the second half than I was the first half, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah. It's like the first four episodes are book one of Fatale.
There you go. But
I don't know about that. Considering you kind of hated the first book of Fatale.
I didn't hate the first three episodes of True Detective either, but I'll get into it.
Yeah, I didn't hate those episodes. It was just kind of like, it was very difficult to watch them, and I was like, I don't think I'm going to have enough time to get to all these shows before the end, before tonight. And what we ended up doing, after that fourth episode, both Cammy and I were like on fire for the rest of it. We watched episodes 5 and 6 together. Or wait, how did we do that? No, we only had time for 5, but then we watched 6, 7, and 8. So we watched 3 hours of True Detective, you know, and then basically had an existential crisis like after that. We're like, ah! But there were so many much more holy shit moments in the latter half of the whole storyline that were like, I can't believe that. I can't, why would he do that? Did he just say that to that woman? Like, all those kind of things.
I know what that scene was.
And you can't give it up, because if you haven't watched it, you really should.
Talk about it later.
From a distance, I would say it's a very, very good 8-episode series. I'm still kind of digesting it a little bit, but I mean, I feel like it was just the right length. It was paced well. The acting is phenomenal. I'll be making the Woody Harrelson face for the rest of my that scowl, that perma scowl he has on all the time. The one thing that drove me nuts about it, though, and I don't want to get into spoiler territory, but it was all Marty, Woody Harrelson's character. His moral failings were so frustrating to me.
You can talk about the fact that he cheats on his wife left and right.
Yeah. His moral failings are egregious and clumsy and stupid. And you just kind of go like, how can you be a detective and not delete, you know, a text picture that you get, you moron? Like, That was so frustrating to me.
It's well established that he is not the strength of their detective team.
He's riding high
because he's with a guy that knows what he's doing, or the guy that's dedicated enough to do the work.
Right.
And they're both flawed characters, and I think that Marty's womanizing, it makes him so real. Like, it's like, I mean, not that I could relate with it or anything, but it these aren't heroes, and that's a huge part of what the story's saying.
True. The other thing that I was... the other thing that I'd taken away from it in a recap that I had read, because you try and get to, like, well, what is it all about? What is True Detective really about? Is it just a story that we're being told? Is it supposed to have some sort of commentary on society at large? You know, is it just this one case? You know what I mean? And the thing that one article that I read and I really kind of latched onto the idea is that True Detective is about storytelling, and its caution is to be careful of what stories you put in your own head, including True Detective, because the killer is motivated by a certain zeal that I won't get too specific about. You know, Rust is constantly being accused of leading the case where he wants it to go. You know, so there's all these kind of repeating themes about, like, well, be careful of what you interpret and be careful of what you believe, be careful of what you take to heart, because it can affect your actions. So I think it would almost take a second viewing for me to pick that out a little bit better. But after the binge watching that we did the last three episodes, I read a recap and I was like, that really rang true.
For me, pacing was a big issue, especially early on. And just as an advertisement for people to listen to the triple feature during and after the show, I think it was after the fourth or fifth episode, after we stopped recording, Gordon and I talked about True Detective, about the pacing of it, how it's a well-made show, but I felt that the first three episodes were, like Fatale, saying a lot of things but not really saying anything and not progressing and not... you know, developing as monumentally as I would like. But, I mean, the payoff in the last five episodes is insane because there's such a richness to these characters and a richness to the world that they live in and the timelines that we see them in, that when the pieces start coming together and the big shit starts happening, it's like, it's crazy. It's really is so much fun, and it's so great that the internet finally caught on with it and we were able to enjoy it as a community. And I feel bad for people that didn't watch it because they're going to watch it and, like, 3 months from now be like, hey, True Detective is crazy. It's like, no shit, asshole. You're the Yellow King. Like, like it's just so much fun. And I mean, that's a big part of TV is in enjoying it with other people. And we talked about that after one of the shows too. But yeah, for me, pacing early on was rough, but worth it in the long run.
I want to piggyback on what Joe is saying about people watching it all at the same time, because there were things that I started to see it show up in pop culture, and I saw, you know, like, it got mentioned on Jimmy Fallon one night and somewhere else, I think. But they're making parody videos of, like, what Marty was looking at, that video, what's on that video. You get a sense of it, but you're never really shown. You know, and so, you know, fan theories were starting to develop, and I was like, I'm missing this. And I was pissed about that, but it didn't diminish my enjoyment of it overall. It would have been nice. The fan interaction, I think, would have been the cherry on top to theorize alongside these guys instead of just going, like, get me to the next thing. I want to see what happens next. Sometimes that kind of give and take between, you know, watching the episode and having to wait a week is as much fun as just watching the thing straight through.
For sure.
You know, it's funny because, like, that kind of thing never really appeals to me that much. Like I said, you know, I was always a movie guy, not a TV guy, so I never really had this experience, and I don't really have this experience too often of watching a show as it happens and you know, being able to talk about it with people. Like, most of the time, you know, I would be at the office at previous jobs, and people would be like, oh, did you see the newest whatever, and I'd be like, lost. I've seen one episode. Okay.
I mean, that's saying something, because movies don't really hit that kind of cultural shock that in the same way. I mean, you look at something like The Crying Game or Sixth Sense. But those are movies that are 10 and 20 years old.
Right, right.
Like, when's the last time it really happened?
How many times does Star Wars come out in a year, you know? Something like that. On that level. And, you know, not that True Detective is anywhere near that level. It was watched by, you know, a few million people, I think, on its biggest night. A couple million, actually, maybe.
And then it shuts down HBO Go. Like, that's the thing. Everyone's watching it after the fact. But
well, no, actually, that includes HBO Go numbers. HBO is always always quick to point out or include their HBO Go figures over, like, the whole week, too, because, you know, the number of people that actually watch it live on HBO is kind of small, you know. Even for their flagship series, 6 Feet Under, I think their largest viewing was 4 million or something. A lot of people watch stuff on.
Wait. 6 Feet Under is their flagship and not The Sopranos or Sexy City?
Ratings wise.
Sexy City.
I might be wrong about Sex and the City, but I think ratings wise, yeah, 6 Feet Under was.
Yeah, really?
I went to a viewing party for the Sex and the City finale. Like, why would I do that if it wasn't huge?
But yeah, so the whole cultural aspect, which in, by the way, in media studies we call the paratextual context. No, I don't know. that never really registers with me, but it was kind of fun, you know, getting in on that. And I guess I had a little bit with Game of Thrones this past season.
Well, Gordon, wait, sorry to interrupt. It does register with you, only because earlier you were saying, how come no one's talking about this? Like, you were aware.
It was,
busted, paratextually. Is that right?
Owned. The thing is, like, I didn't get too worked up in, like, the theories. And I think once we get into spoiler territory, we can talk about that a little bit more. But I don't get all, like, I wasn't really concerned with who the Yellow King was because I had faith that we would either find out or not in the course of the series. I trust the creators. That whole kind of extra-textual, paratextual, actually, that is what they call it, aspect isn't something I care about. I wasn't the guy, like, reading the website on Donnie Darko, trying to figure out what that was all about. I wasn't, you know, devouring every last Matrix video game or whatever. I did watch the Animatrix, but that's because they were cartoons. But not what I'm that interested in. And but it does, you know, the communal aspects of basically talking on Twitter about it, except kind of making sure that people don't talk about spoilers too much because that's shitty. That is fun. I'm rambling now, so
well, you know, take over. I really think there is something to watching these shows in real time. Lost is a show that I don't think you can watch. I don't know, maybe you can, but I remember watching Lost when it was on and being very, very satisfied in the theorizing. And now I've talked to friends who are like, oh, I missed out on all that, so I'm catching up on Netflix, and they don't get it. They don't enjoy it as much. And, you know, whether or not Lost was the be-all, end-all of, you know, television, metaphysical whodunits, or whatever, is up for debate. That's fair. But I really felt like the fan theorizing helped give that show momentum that it doesn't have on Netflix.
I mean, Lost was crazy in that way. Lost for me was the first show where, like, the next morning I'm listening to podcasts about it.
Right.
I'm going on to websites that show, like, the hieroglyphics on the wall just so I can have a clue to what's happening in the next week. That was a crazy experience. And it's nice that that sort of hit the internet the way it did, because now we get stuff like that for Breaking Bad, with, like, podcasts for Breaking Bad by the creators. It's amazing. And it's so much fun. And it heightens the experience. It extends the experience. Unfortunately, you don't get it for season one shows like True Detective, but, you know, next year there's going to be True Detective podcasts, and they're going to be, you know, probably pretty terrible. But the one fan theory I would say people should watch is someone made a goof Yellow King theory video about, like, now I know, you know, there's a lot of things going on in this show, but I think it's the Yellow King. And, you know, this is going to talk to death and everything, but it's hilarious, and I'll say no more, but it's hilarious.
Okay, so I think those of you who don't want to get spoiled, or those of you who are bored now, should probably tune out. I think we'd like to get into spoiler territory for True Detective. So if you've seen it all or you just don't care, stick around, and I think we could get into some massive spoilers. Like, like that the Yellow King was Marty's wife the whole time.
Oh my god!
Oh my god.
The show is great in that way because it really, like, immediately it's like, well, who's the Yellow King? Do you think it's Russ? Do you think it's Marty? Like, they make it, everyone is a legitimate red herring. Oh, is she a part of the Tuttle family? Maybe she's behind it all. Or maybe she's that little girl that was in the video. Like, they leave it open. And that's fun, because every fan theory that's crazy is legitimate.
the thing is, I thought it was sort of clear that the Yellow King was that cult group worshipped. Well, maybe it wasn't clear.
But that still could have been Marty or Rust. Mm. There's a point where it's like, wow, Russ is really trying to solve this shit. Like, there's no way, he's the Yellow King.
I did the biggest amount of fanboy that I got for this show was that I would read interviews with Nick Pizzolatto or Cary Fukunaga, and I did watch the making ofs, whatever, after each episode, after the first couple of weeks, because I was just like, I love this show so much, it needs to get to me. it's funny because in episode 4, when they talk about the tracking shot, I was like, that was a tracking shot? It didn't even register to me. And so, as soon as they mentioned that, I went back and rewatched it.
Oh, no. I mean, I had awareness of that going into it, what it was, but actually watching it unfold, I was like, oh my gosh, it's so complex. And I mean, I think there's one or two soft edits in there. Where
I don't think there are. There aren't any.
Are you sure? Because I thought there was one where they pointed up to a helicopter.
Oh, yeah, I guess they could have fit one in there, but I think that was more to just kind of get choreography in place.
Or
possibly avoid seeing equipment.
that shot is really crazy, and it is one of those things where, a minute into it, I tapped my wife, and I was like, this isn't broke yet. This is happening.
Right.
We're in the middle of something. This is special. Everybody calm down.
I think we're going to do it.
I just think it's funny that I didn't notice it, because I noticed it in Children of Men. I was like, they haven't cut yet.
Children of Men, though.
What's going on?
Children of Men has three of those shots, though, before they do the big boy one. And they're all great.
Yeah. It's such a good movie. I don't know. So, I mean, I did read a few things, and I did know that Nick Pizzolatto was like, twists like that where they completely upend, like making Rust the killer would have been the shittiest possible ending. It would have been a betrayal of the reader or the viewer's trust, I think. And he said something to that effect, more or less, I think.
Had he considered it?
I think it was off the table completely.
Okay, great.
Yeah, and it really kind of drove me a little nuts when people actually bought into the fact that the modern day detectives were considering him. Of course, it has to be believable that it was him; otherwise, they wouldn't be looking. But it doesn't like the amount of footage that we saw of him actually trying to solve this thing, it would have been just a slap in the face.
He had to have been schizophrenic or lost time, or they talked about him having hallucinations from his stint on Narco, and you wonder how much that plays a role. When they were kind of leading you down that road, it could be him. Maybe he's drinking and blacking out and killing people, or you know what I mean?
What's great about Rust as a red herring is there's a point in the show where you're like, he's really into this. There's no way it's him. And it's at that same point where he's like, this is my storage shit. And he lifts it up, and you're like, if anybody finds this, he can't, he's the guy.
There were no fingerprints on the video cassette. He was smart enough about that.
Yeah.
Right. They had that scene where they gave it to that sheriff. They go, put this video in the thing and play it. And I was like, oh! You shouldn't have done that. I knew immediately that's where that was turned around, because when they'd shown them put on these gloves, you know, and then they give it to the guy, like, that guy's screwed. He's done. He's done.
There was actually one, every once in a while, you know, it's not a perfect TV show. It's damn near perfect. But there were a couple of things that kind of pulled me out every now and then. I have to admit, the identity of the killer being kind of like the mega hick was a mild disappointment, but it was like a split second, and then I got over it, because the way everything else played out was brilliant. But one thing about the storage shed kind of made me roll my eyes just slightly. When you walk in, and it rests written on the walls, Carcosa, the being. I was just like, okay, that's a little nutty.
And on the back,
you're gonna lose your deposit on that storage shed, Russ. Exactly. You buy on the walls like that.
Exactly. Yeah. On the back of the door, he's got like this big spiral symbol that was on one of the wood.
Right.
Like, come on, buddy. Well, that took you half a night, and what did it do? It took you half a night to put that up there.
That's the kind of thing that, like, the TV set director is like, "Oh, this is badass," and it's like, mm-hmm. No, it just looks kind of dumb.
Now, you said something about the reveal that it's just a backwoods hick, and I think there's something to be said about, like, in episode 7, they basically say this is the guy they're looking for. This is Crazy Face. Mm-hmm. And in episode 8, like, even going into episode 8, you're like, oh, is Crazy Face the Yellow King for sure? Or is there another level to this? And you go into that last episode saying, okay, like, what's the big mystery? What's the big reveal? And even though almost everybody, is satisfied with how it ended, everybody is still a little bit upset that there was not a big something. That, at the end, it sort of goes through the Texas Chainsaw emotions, and just sort of, like, you know, there's hoarders, and then there's a secret place, and there's a fight, and there's a result. But it's not like... It's not like, he puts on a crown and says, I'm the Yellow King, and they fight it out or anything.
It's me!
It's not like at the end of The Birds, they fight a giant king bird. It's not like that. They just go away.
Bird.
Yeah, and see, that didn't bother me. It was a little anticlimactic.
That's all I'm saying. Right. Even the tiniest bit.
Okay. Right. But it didn't bother me in terms of the story, because I felt like the story, like, I think as soon as that happened, I realized that that wasn't the story, that the story was about Rust and Marty.
Yeah.
And that's why the denouement.
Denouement.
The denouement was so long is because they were the real story. It was their relationship in Act 3, episodes, you know, 6 through 8 or whatever, were them getting back together and solving this thing, 7 and 8, I forget exactly. I think Nick Pizzolatto mentioned in one of the making of type featurettes that 1 through 3 were Act 1, 4 through 6, something like that. Anyway, might be wrong. I have a bad memory, but
that denouement, though, where they're really saying what it's all about, and Kanye gives that monologue about what it was really about. That's their footage for their Emmy wins. Like, so good. Like, no matter how you felt about there not being a huge climax or a huge reveal or a huge surprise, you can't deny those performances. They're so good.
Right. I seriously cry, actually. it wasn't like bawling or anything, but McConaughey got some legit tears out of me. And like he they were both amazing. Marty.
I typically shot back.
What the hell? Sorry.
No. Marty. His role, Woody Harrelson's role, is definitely a little less in your face than Rust. So, you know, he kind of is going to get unfairly overlooked. But yeah, no, McConaughey It was amazing.
It's a spotlight for him for sure. But I don't know. They're both so good.
I think that recap that I was talking about earlier, they talked about how the last episode is actually a happy ending.
Yeah.
Which Cammy kind of walked away with it with something else, but I was like, yeah, I kind of get it. Because, I don't know, McConaughey's last scene is very effective, and it does give you some hope for him as a character that he can kind of move and heal, you know. I don't know. I don't want to get too deep into it because I think it's very satisfying. I think people should watch that for themselves. But
what's great is they can have this happy ending where these two characters talking about hope and light versus darkness, but they're still believable as the monsters that we watched all season. You know, monsters is a strong word, but Marty's kind of a giant douchebag, and Rust is a cold, emotionalist bastard, and. Yeah. You can watch them in that scene, and you can cry in that scene, even though, but they're still believable as those two anti-heroes, or whatever you want to call them.
Yeah, they're not exactly people you'd want to, like, hang out with.
No, this is not the EdTV guys. This is not...
yeah, it's funny because, like, this comes up so much, this idea that the characters need to be likable, and I think the distinction... For me, at least, is that an interesting character is a likable character. They're not necessarily a likable person, and I definitely draw that a massive distinction between the person that the character is and them as a character. Rust and Marty are amazing characters, but yeah, they're both shitty people. So Nick Pizzolatto obviously is moving on to True Detective Season 2. He's writing it right now. It hasn't been officially announced, so I think they're probably saving that for, you know, lining up a director or directors. They've said a few times that although Cary Fukunaga is obviously not coming back to direct the whole series, he may stay on in production, producer, whatever capacity. And that it's slightly, probably unlikely that the entire series will be directed by one person, again, simply because of logistics.
Can you imagine if they put Fincher on this? You kind of can. It's a little scary.
The internet would crack in half. I would actually be surprised if they get big name directors for this, because they don't need them. At this point, Fukunaga very likely could, you know, has set the tone for the whole series.
They don't need him for sure. But I mean, directors are as attracted to the long form storytelling as the A-list stars are. That's why you see people like Rian Johnson dropping in to do episodes of Breaking Bad. Mm-hmm. And I could see that easily for if Fincher's like, hey, I want to do a long form shot in True Detective. They're not going to be like, I don't know. Come on. We're busy. We're all booked up with Joe Schmo and Tom Brazelton.
You know, I would actually... I would say the biggest name director that they have a good chance of getting is somebody like Jodie Foster, who has directed an episode of Orange is the New Black and an episode of House of Cards.
And the theatrical release of The Beaver. She's great, though. She knows what she's doing.
She does. But... You know, she doesn't overpower, she didn't overpower either show with any sort of distinctive visual approach. And that's, at this point, they don't really need somebody to do that, like I was saying.
Do you guys have any hope or expectation in terms of the detectives? Like, who they cast? Maybe not who they cast, but how they cast. Like, what kind of relationship?
Right.
I was thinking about this. I'm less concerned about who they cast versus where they shoot, because spending 8 weeks in Gulf, you know, Louisiana made me never want to visit there. It made it look horrible. I feel bad for the tourism department of Louisiana right now because I'm never coming to your state.
But their badges are shaped like Louisiana.
That was cool. That was cool. I'm less concerned about where. I'm not very concerned about who they cast for it at all, because if Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson was enough of a head scratcher for me, then to go like the MTV guys, they could put in Seth Rogen and Jonah Hill if the writing's good. I mean, like, and the perform. Well, we need the performances. We gotta raise that up a notch. But you know what I mean? I feel like it's so driven by the writing.
Yeah, it's definitely a writer's show. I don't know. I definitely would like to see it in a completely different geographic location, outside of the South, maybe. Part, if only because it would completely eliminate that urge, or whatever, to fall back on hick cliches, which I wouldn't say he did too much in True Detective, but there were a few times where it did seem a little too familiarly Southern Gothic.
A little bit, but it also blends in with the whole cult aspect of the, the enemy. And is that something that needs to carry over? If this takes place in Minnesota, if it takes place in Fargo, if a Fargo show wasn't happening, but if it's that sort of environment with two yokel Fargo cops, do they have to do a cultist storyline?
I think Pizzolatto said that it has something to do with sort of occult undertones of the U.S. Transportation Department or something like that.
What does that even mean? I read that too, and I was like, okay. Yeah,
I have no idea what that
means. Like human trafficking?
No. Like
train robberies?
Highways and train routes and stuff like that. Or airport layouts. I've read a little bit. I don't know. The thing is, like, that could always change. He could completely chuck it if HBO is like, eh.
Well, where do you shoot it at this point? Because if you do it in a big city somewhere, then you're just another SVU. You know what I mean?
You're an SVU that has a brain, maybe.
Right, but I mean, it's, you know, and if you do it in, like, Miami, it's almost stunt casting, but on location. So, like, you know, if you do it in Fargo, if you do it, like, in the suburbs, that's a trick.
That TV series called Fargo.
Yeah, I know.
Martin Freeman's in that. I had no idea. I saw a commercial the other day. Martin Freeman's in Fargo. That's great.
Yeah, that'll actually get me to probably check it out.
But Billy Bob's in it too. I think Fargo's pretty cool. The thing about, I mean, the occult is that like every location has their niche, like. You could do it in Hawaii, and you have these beautiful scenes, but you also have, like, this dark, like, I don't want to say voodoo, because I know that's wrong, but they have their own, like, you know what I'm saying. They have their own, and you could find that anywhere. Like, you can go anywhere and really find some sort of dark corner of that landscape.
Yeah.
I'm kind of hoping that whatever they do, that they continue to play with time a little bit, because it was so interesting to watch how, you know, the stuff that was set in 1995 started to catch up to the future. And, like, when Matthew McConaughey walks out of that interrogation room or that interview room or whatever, like, when he walks out of it, I'm like, oh! Like, that was almost like a minor tremor. It was like, oh, it's going to happen. Something's going to happen outside this room in the present tense now. That was interesting to me. Right. So it would almost be cool if they could do something completely removed from a modern context. Why not do a period piece? Why not do something in the 50s like Fatale? Or, you know what I mean? Like, you could really do anything if you're not stepping into characters.
Piece at some point. It shouldn't all be in the modern day, just because why limit yourself? But beyond that, honestly, and I don't say this to be completely dismissive, but I just want Pizzolatto to do what he wants to do.
Sure. Yeah.
He knows what he's doing, as far as I'm concerned. I would say it is one of my favorite TV series of ever. and not because it's like some amazingly brilliant masterpiece, but because it is such a singularly well-conceived work. And so well made and so well acted. And maybe that is the definition of a masterpiece.
Here's the thing, though. The sophomore season of this show, it doesn't matter if it sucks. People will always say, like, oh, that first episode was, or that first season was great, and that could happen again. So people will always come back. So, I mean, it doesn't matter. Just because they'll reboot at 3. They'll reboot at 4. Like, it'll be New Detectives at 3, New Detectives at 4. So it doesn't matter if the second season sucks.
Anyway, I think that can be enough for the night. Thanks for everybody at Patreon and elsewhere for watching, and thanks again for everybody at Patreon for the support of Multiplex and the triple feature as well and everything else. We don't know what we're going to talk about in roughly 2 weeks, but I'll let you know when we figure that one out. Thanks again, and have a good night.